The Flatus Show is brought to you by Douglas Brothers Apple Pectin Pea Powder Organic Soap, cleansing and rejuvenating hands and faces since 1923.
This podcast is a proud member of the Network of One Podcast. And also the Freak Network at thefreaknetwork.com.
On today's Bill of the Flatus Show, episode 125, Hemingway, Temperance, Whitey Bulger, and Hand Soap. All of this and more. The Flatus Show with Kenty and Jose. Welcome to the Flatus Show. Mmm, a low-calorie carbonated beverage for my diet. Mmm. Yes, kids, it's a low-calorie carbonated beverage. It is seltzer water, and it is calorie and sodium-free, and it is the generic brand. So I get a whole 12 cans of it for like $3. And it's delicious. It's a little flavored, too. This one here is mandarin orange flavor. And there's no calories. And there's no sodium. And there's no caffeine. And it's wonderful. Actually, it didn't say no caffeine. Nope, there's no caffeine. Welcome to the Flatus Show. My the co-host who's standing in for Jose is Francois, the mute sound technician, migrant sound technician from Canada. He is taking a nap on the couch in the studio here at Flatus Studios. Jose, as you know, is on a sabbatical, and he is taking a trip before he comes back to decide whether he's going to continue being the co-host of the Flatus Show. As you know, he's been playing hardball. We tried and tried and tried to get him to sign earlier, but he said he wouldn't do it. So he's using his unused vacation time to travel America, visiting other podcasters. He was in Columbus, Ohio this past week, and then I hadn't heard from him. He was just to see George, Zillafag's dog, and then he was going to go see Joe G. I don't know what happened, you know, when he got there. But he's on his way to Phoenix, Arizona now for some warmth. And says he's going to see Darren and Jim from Shop Pink. We'll find out what happens. I haven't heard anything from him. I believe he is in Phoenix, or at least he arrived in Arizona. I got an email the other day. So, but he's been, you know, keeping to himself. He thinks he's all that in a bag of chips. You know that, Jose? So, yeah, Jose is traveling. So, yes, welcome to the Flatus Show. It's been another busy week for Kenty. And it is a Sunday, and I'm running late here. I was going to get this stuff done earlier, but I had to go shopping. Did I tell you, I think I told you last week about our what we're doing here for... Changing our diet. Not necessarily changing our diet, but being more aware. Johnny and I are becoming more aware of what we're eating, and so we're measuring out everything. So what I do is I buy a chicken breast and like a crap load of them, cook them, I boil them in water, and chop them up to make little packages, little 100-gram packages of chicken. And that's the serving size, the 100 grams of chicken. And I did that with beef the other day. And we used that up, and it was really good. I had bought some more beef. I want to cook that just like I did. And I bought beef heart, you know, today. Isn't that interesting? It was 94 cents. So I'm cooking that right now. We'll see what it tastes like. And some interesting things. I have a cooking episode next week. I was going to do Brenda Starr and a cooking episode this week, but everything is running too late, so I'll have to do it next week, the Brenda Starr update and a cooking segment. this week. And also, last week, I wanted to mention something. I went to a bookstore in here in Rockport called Toad Hall, and it's on Main Street. They have a website, toadhallbooks.org, and it's a very interesting bookstore because it is nonprofit. The money that... Let me see here. Toad Hall has always contributed its net profits to environmental projects. Founded in 1972 as a direct result of Earth Day, the bookstore has funded countless projects, mostly in the form of local seed money grants. And it has a list of the various things it has funded in the area. But it was apparently... I don't know the whole story. I want to interview the manager of the bookstore. But they sell new and used books, and the money goes to help the environment, you know. So go check out toadhallbooks.org. I'm not sure if they have if they sell books online, but if they do, I urge you to go buy your books from Toad Hall Books. It's, you know, their books are becoming the way of, I don't know, the dodo bird, it seems. But I don't think we'll ever get rid of books. How can you get rid of a book, you know? I mean, I like the idea of the Kindle and stuff and the electronic books devices because, you know, there's a lot of books which I don't want to keep, but I want to read. So that makes sense. And I, from what I understand, that's the right size. You can carry it with you. But they're expensive. I'm not sure if I want to shell out 400 books for a Kindle, though, right? It would save a lot of space, you know. But, you know, I already have books. I have a crap load of books already. I guess any new book I would buy and put it in there, I don't know how it works. But I like writing in my books and doing things like that. I don't know if you can make notes with the Kindle or the whatever machine. I just say Kindle because that's the one in the news. I think it's Amazon.com has developed that one. So how are you doing? It's doing pretty good. Let me see, how much time do I have here? 6 minutes, huh? Well, actually, you know what? I might be able to give you the recipe. I was talking about food and exercise, right? And by the way, I've been nailing my exercises. You know, getting, you know, doing, you know, just increasing the weight enough and finishing off the each repetition perfectly and just nailing it. And it's really a great, you know, feeling when you can, you know, have a really good workout, you know. I've been doing these, I've been alternating my weightlifting with days where I do the squats. But I have been cheating because I've been using the squat machine, this squat rack. It's a hack squat rack machine, but it actually works my legs pretty good. But I really want a squat rack to do real squats at the gym, but they don't have that yet. I have to talk to the guy and see if they can get that put in. And then alternating squat days. I don't know why I yawn. Okay, I want to alternate squat days with the days I do deadlifts. So I'm working like upper lower body, you know, alternating that, and it's working out pretty good. And I have been creating little recipes so I can take my food to work and get enough protein during the day for my muscles to grow, to feed my body right, because that's important. And that's that. Not a lot, Sarita. Okay. I had a phone call, which I'll play right now.
Hi, this is Marvin Bloom. How are you? I just listened to your program where you quoted Doris Lessing, and you were talking about mind control. It just really spoke to me very powerfully about how people's minds get controlled. And I understand this because I'm a Christian. I'm a born-again Christian. You know, and so the God of this world, the devil, he prowls around like a roaring lion, seeking whom he may devour. And, you know, some of us are particularly tasty to him. But, you know, what I have to do as a Christian is I have to guard my mind, you know, and put on the whole armor of God and take on the mind of Christ and go to church as often as I can and read the Bible and read very good Christian materials, not like the crappy ones. And that keeps me from being controlled, you know, because it's Christ in me controlling me, not the world or the God of this world. So if you want ultimate protection, you know, from being mind controlled, become born again, go to a good church, and, you know, trust the Lord. All right? Okay. God bless you.
Thank you, Marvin Bloom. Thank you. Always a pleasure. Always a pleasure to hear from you. And so, if you don't want to be mind controlled, become born again. And get a good church, find a good church, and you know, then you don't have to worry about being controlled by people or Satan or whatever. What do you think, Marvin? Is it really working? Doris Lessing. I don't know, Marvin. You know, it could be that maybe you're brainwashed by your religion. Did you ever think about that? Roar like a lion. I know I'm going to hear. I might hear from that. I don't know. Scare him away. See, you know, Marvin is the only one who's ever called the show and witnessed to me trying to save my eternal soul from damnation. Because I'm a Unitarian. But I'm a Unitarian, Marvin. And I wanted to show something. Last week, if you remember, right, there was a woman in the Tocqueville sequence, and she said something about Unitarians, which I'm going to play for you. And it just makes me so proud because, you know what, it is true.
Now, the Methodists are considered as the most pious. The Presbyterians as the most powerful. The Episcopalians and the Catholics as the most genteel. The Universalists the most liberal. The Swedenborgians the most musical. The Unitarians the most enlightened. The Quakers, the most amiable, the Dancing Shakers, the most amusing, and the Jews, the most interesting. I know a respectable family where one is a Methodist, one a Presbyterian, and a third a Universalist.
Okay.
The Unitarians, the most enlightened.
That's nice. Thank you, dear. And yeah, the Swedenborgians are musical. The last little part here before we start the show, all right? I found some LPs the other day, and there's a record store here in Cape Ann. It's in Gloucester, called Mystery Train, and they sell it's all used. They don't have any. I don't think they have any new stuff, but I like used record stores. I have vinyl, and I like it. I love it. Except. It takes up a lot of space and it's heavy. And if I were ever to decide to move, I don't know what I'd do with all my vinyl, I'll tell you the truth. But, I mean, I have to do something, right? I have to do something with all my heavy vinyl. But it is impressive to see in a room. So anyway, I found some, this Mystery Train, they give away, like, LPs in the front. You know, stuff they can't sell. And that's the stuff I like because it's, like, weird stuff. So I found this LP. It's from the United Artists label from the 60s, and it has a selection of artists from the United Artists label. Jan Pierce had an album, and so there's a couple songs from a Jan Pierce album. And then there was Edie Gourmet and Steve Lawrence. So Edie Gourmet sings this song called I'm So Spanish or something, or Feel So Spanish. And She mentions Hemingway in it. And I thought, you know, what year was this LP? And I think the LP was from like 1966. And I'm thinking, when did Hemingway die? And Hemingway died in 1961. So let me know. I'm going to show you what I found about Hemingway. Hold on. Can you hear me? I need to print out something. Hold on. I'm back, Francine. Okay, so I looked up this Edie Gourmet. It says here, 1961, Edie Gourmet achieved her ambition, and I Feel So Spanish succeeds on both counts. So that was when she did it. She sang that song in 1961. That's when she achieved her success. That is the year that Hemingway killed himself in Idaho. I think Idaho. So what do you think? Do you think Hemingway heard this song and said, fuck this shit, and took the gun and shot himself? Because it makes sense that this is the reason why Hemingway killed himself. So I'm going to play this song for you. So you can hear it for yourself, to know that this is what killed Hemingway, what made him decide to kill himself. So there you go.
I bought a fan for my hair, bought a shawl to wear. Aye, 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 aye. So Spanish for tonight, love guitars, even love cigars. Ay, 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 ay. I feel so Spanish for my new Easter hat. I've ordered a fat sombrero, one for throwing away while shouting ole torero. Ay, 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 castanets, play your wild duet. Brazil, they do the samba. In Colombia, the mambo. In Brooklyn, a charanga. In Miami, it's a cha-cha-cha. But I do the tango while waving my fan. I feel so Spanish. Spanish. Ay, 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 I feel so Spanish. For my new Easter hat, I've ordered a fat sombrero, one for throwing away while shouting, ole, torero! Ay, 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 castanets, play your crazy. They do the samba. In Colombia, the mambo. In Brooklyn, the charanga. In Miami, it's the cha-cha-cha. But I do the tango while waving my fan. I feel so
Now, on with the show.
Here's one of the most dangerous men in the world, James Whitey Bulger. He's on the FBI's top 10 list, and there's a $1 million reward for information leading to his arrest.
Where the cough medicine was strong. Did you have trouble? Did you take that? A little bit, not that. That was devastating, wasn't it? Let's see if my brother Jackie wants any.
These recordings were made before Bulger, wanted on murder and other charges, was a fugitive.
Can I speak to Jack? Thank you. Hi, Jack. Is there any rentals up at that place up across from Kelly's? Okay. Gonna find out now. I think that's the Marine Park, they call it. What do they call it? The Marine Park? Yeah, is it the Marine Park they call it? Okay. You had one for sale recently? Or is it for sale now? What floor is it on? Oh, first floor? No, good. Yeah.
Whitey Bulger's wanted flyer is on the internet at FBI.gov. I'm Neil Schiff of the Bureau, and that's what's happening at the FBI this week.
You stand convicted of assholism.
Today's assholes, the MBCR, the company which manages the commuter rail for the MBTA. And, you know, they're just assholes. We pay them top dollar to ride trains which break down all the time, sometimes aren't heated, in the summer aren't cooled down. This company thinks they're all that in a bag of chips and that they're fiscally responsible when they've done nothing. They've put no money into the infrastructure of the train system, and they have their head up their ass. So they're the asshole of the week.
Assholism!
Zoroastrianism, spark of the sacred fire, 2, in the land of Iran long ago. Northwest of India, close to the Caspian Sea, there lived many, many centuries ago a people called Iranians in a land called Iran. From what we know now, the Iranians were very much like the people who invaded India and who later wrote the Vedas. They talked a language much like that of India nearly 4,000 years ago. They believed in many gods, like the gods of India at that time, and they worshipped the cow, as the Hindus did. But the Hindus were in India, and the Iranians were in Iran, and the climate and the conditions in the two countries were not the same. Being much farther to the north, it was colder in Iran, and where the climate is much colder, people must have more clothes to wear, richer food to eat, and warmer houses to live in. And in order to get more clothes, richer food, and warmer houses, they must work much harder and longer than people in warm climates. Iran was also a place where savage tribes from the Arabian deserts and the Caucasian plains swooped down upon the land, robbed the people of their cattle, and plundered their crops. The life of the Iranian shepherd and farmer was not an easy life to lead. His southern Hindu neighbor lived a peaceful life, but the life of the Iranian was full of hardships, fear, and danger. When people were hungry and troubled, they were apt to think less of life after death than of bread and peace. And so, when the Iranians prayed to their many gods, they prayed not to Nirvana, as did the Hindus, but for the crops to be plentiful and for victory over their enemies. Living always in fear of nomad tribes, the Iranians began to look upon every man who did not do some useful work as an evil person. Only the tillers of the soil and the herders of the sheep and cattle were respected and considered good. In India, there were thousands upon thousands of monks who lived on charity. Yet they were highly respected by the people. But in Iran, any man who did not work for his livelihood was looked down upon and distrusted. Their struggle for existence was hard. Their methods of irrigating and cultivating the land were very primitive, and whatever crop they succeeded in raising, they raised with much trouble and labor. Naturally, they hated anyone who expected to share the fruits of their labor with them without himself doing anything in return. Like all farmers of long, long ago, the Iranians worshipped many nature gods. They worshipped the sun god that ripened their crops. They worshipped the rain god that watered their fields. They worshipped the cloud god and the wind god and all the other nature gods that helped them in their work. These helpful nature gods they called Daivas, good spirits. When the winter ended and spring began, and it was seeding time on the land, the Iranians would go up to the mountains and pray to their nature gods to help them raise a good crop that year. And when the summer ended and the crops were gathered, the Iranians would go up to the mountaintops again, worship and praise the nature gods, and make sacrifices of fruit and grain and young lambs. That was a very simple religion. But it did not remain simple for very long, for the people of Iran began to believe not only in the Daivas, the good spirits of nature, but also in clan gods, family gods, and many other kinds of gods and spirits. With the multiplication of their gods, images, and idols, made their appearance. With the multiplication of their gods, images and idols made their appearance. They chiseled them out of stone, they molded them out of clay, and they painted them on the panels of wood. The rich people made their idols of gold and silver. The Iranians no longer went out into the fields or up into the mountains to worship their gods. With the appearance of idols in Iran, temples were built to them, and there the people gathered to offer up sacrifices and prayers. Gradually, the prayers, hymns, and sacrifices to the different gods increased. The people who were busy tilling the soil and looking after their flocks and protecting their property against the nomad tribes and their enemies could not remember all the hymns that they had to sing to the different gods, nor they could remember which prayers ought to be murmured at what time. And they did not know what was the proper sacrifice to make to one god that would not make the other gods angry or jealous. So they employed certain men who had learned just exactly how to make the sacrifices and when to sing the right hymns to the right god. These people, who looked after the idols in the temples, were called priests. Because the priests were always in the company of the gods, they began to believe that they were better than all the other people in Iran. They also claimed that they knew how to please the daivas, the good spirits, and in that way make the gods do whatever they, the priests, wished. The Iranians believed their priests. They looked upon them as intermediaries between the gods and the people. Whenever the Iranians went to war, they took their priests and favorite idols along to help them win their battles. The priests who claimed that they could influence the idols and control the outcome of wars were called magi, and the methods they used in influencing the gods were called magic. If the magi could influence the gods to win their wars for them, so the people thought, surely they can even more easily influence the gods to make their cows give more milk, make their fields bear better crops, and grow more wool upon their sheep. The magi said that if they only wished to, they could do all those things and much more. The belief in the power of the magi spread among the people, and idol worship and sorcery and the belief in magic became worse and worse in the land of Iran. Douglas Brothers Apple Pectin and Pea Powder Soap, made with all natural and organic ingredients. Using apples and peas from Washington State, Douglas Brothers blends a soap formula that gently cleanses your skin while adding tone. This formula has been cleansing and rejuvenating hands and faces since 1923.
The ideas of progress and of the indefinite perfectibility of the human race belong to democratic ages. The America of 1831 is devoted to equality, and equality suggests several ideas that would not have originated from any other source, and it modifies almost all those previously entertained. I take as an example the idea of human perfectibility and progress because it is a great philosophical theory, everywhere to be traced by its consequence in the conduct of human affairs. Although man has many points of resemblance with the brutes, one trait is peculiar to himself. He improves. They are incapable of improvement. The idea of perfectibility is as old as the world. Equality did not give birth to it, but equality has imparted to it a new character. An aristocratic society can conceive improvement, but not change. An aristocratic society can imagine the future condition of the world maybe better, but not essentially different. But in a democracy, The image of an ideal, the always fugitive perfection, presents itself to the human mind. Thus it was that when my friend Beaumont and I set foot in the United States in 1831, we were stunned by the tumult.
On every side, 1,000 simultaneous voices demand the satisfaction of their social wants.
Not a reading man, but has a draft of a new community in his vest pocket.
We're all a little wild here with numberless projects of social reform.
We students of Yale, therefore, solemnly form ourselves into a band and vow never to cease in our efforts, but totally to devote ourselves to the salvation of Illinois.
Progress is the great topic of inquiry.
Come, join the Coldwater Army. Join us now, join us now. Come join the Coldwater Army. Join us, now.
Now, brothers, all come at our call and join us in our rendezvous. The pledge to bind, make haste and sign, for 'tis our temperance holiday.
Yes, sisters, all, we've heard your call and join you in your melody. We wind, resign, the pledge we'll sign and sing with you in harmony.
Come join the Coldwater Army. Join us now, join us now. Come join the Coldwater Army. Join us now!
Be ashamed to die until you have won some victory for humanity.
Ancient injustices are no longer tolerable. This association calls for the end of sweatshops and the establishment of the 10-hour working day.
The new College of Overland will ban tea, coffee, meat, fish, pepper and other condiments, gravy, butter, and practically anything with taste enough to be a temptation of the flesh.
As the editor of a newspaper, I must ask for the heavenly compassion of my female readers for my persistence in the sin of celibacy. But I am so much engaged in building up the newspaper and reforming the age that actually I have scarcely time to say, how'd you do?
In a democracy, no one sits quietly in despair of improving his condition.
Bread, rent, fuel, their prices must come down. The people will meet in the park, rain or sunshine, at 4 o'clock on Monday afternoon to inquire into the cause of the present unexampled distress and devise a suitable remedy.
Meetings are called to denounce the government and to deplore the laxity of the day.
Would you believe it? They no longer arrest people who travel on Sundays. And even the mail coach, carrying government dispatches, now goes its rounds on the day of the Lord. If this disastrous trend is not stopped, all is over. Not only with our private morality, but with public morality too.
Societies are formed which regard drunkenness as the principal cause of the evils of the state.
Young man, shun that cup. Touch not a drop therein. In youth it ruined me when filled with rum and gin.
Societies are formed for everything.
Matters have come to such a pass that a peaceable man can hardly venture to eat or drink or to go to bed or to get up, to correct his children or to kiss his wife without obtaining the permission and direction of some society.
It is impossible to spend more effort in the pursuit of happiness. To take a hand in the regulation of society and to discuss it is his biggest concern, and, so to speak, the only pleasure an American knows. Debating clubs are, to a certain extent, a substitute for theatrical entertainments. An American cannot converse, but he can discuss, and his talk falls into a dissertation. He speaks to you as if he were addressing a meeting. And if he should chance to become warm in the discussion, he will address the man he's talking to as gentlemen.
After all, gentlemen, reformers are metallic. They are sharpest steel. They pierce whatsoever of evil or abuse they touch. They are armed in the might of principles. And, gentlemen, God backs their purpose. They uproot institutions, erase traditions, revise usages, and renovate all things. Reformers are the noblest of creatures. Living in time, they work for eternity. Dwelling with men, they are with God.
Forever seeking, forever falling to rise again, often disappointed but not discouraged, the American tends unceasingly toward that unmeasured greatness so indistinctly visible at the end of the long track which humanity has yet to tread.
We live in a period of the world and a stage of society favorable to every charitable institution and useful improvement. Never were the poor and miserable more generously taken care of. In these western countries of the earth, we hailed equal strength and beauty of body. With them we have as improvable and elegant minds, and unless untoward and sad events alter our situation, may exhibit human nature in as favorable a point of view as it has ever yet appeared.
It can hardly be believed how many facts naturally flow from the philosophical theory of the indefinite perfectibility of man, or how strong influence it exercises, even on those who, living entirely for the purposes of action and not of thought, seem to conform their actions to it, without knowing anything about it.
Remember, Tocqueville, our conversation with Mr. Poinsett?
Mr. Poinsett, of course, was also a man of considerable thought.
He was indeed. He was a distinguished world traveler. He had been ambassador to Mexico. He was a personal agent of President Andrew Jackson. And finally, Mr. Poinsett had a beautiful red flower named after him. We met him at a tavern in South Carolina, and together we traveled back to Washington and talked and talked and talked. And in part, we talked about American progress.
We are told, Mr. Poinsett, that Americans are very economical when it comes to managing ships. Why?
Well, Mr. Tocqueville, the American sailor possesses an activity and an economical bent. He has an understanding of his own interests. The price of labor is high. Ships cost more to build here than in Europe, but we look for other ways to make improvements. There's not an English or a French vessel crosses the ocean in as little time as ours. None that stays as short a time in port. I'll tell you something. The American has a quality, land or sea, which makes him singularly apt to succeed and make money.
We have observed that.
Of course you have, sir.
Let me return to these American ships.
Yes, Mr. Bowman?
I have heard it said that these beautiful, fast ships of yours generally don't last very long.
Well, Mr. Beaumont, I think you might begin by... Well, you have to distinguish between ships built for sale and those built for your own use.
I see.
There is in the North a shipbuilding industry. And in fact, the vessels it produces do have a short life. But when we want to make a ship that we can use as long as possible, we find in the building woods of the South, particularly in the live oak of the Floridas, the best materials in the world. What makes our ships last such a short time is the fact that our merchants often don't have much disposable capital to begin with. It's a calculation on their part. Provided that the vessel lasts long enough to bring them in a certain sum, a certain profit, well, that's all they expect. Besides, there's a general feeling among us Americans that prevents our aiming at the durable in anything. There reigns in America a popular and universal faith in the progress of the human mind. Americans are always expecting that improvements will be discovered in everything. And in fact, they are often right.
Does everyone act on this sort of system?
Certainly, Mr. Tocqueville. Any American sailor will tell you that ships aren't built to last... because of progress.
This is Tim.
And this is Nanette.
From For Whatever Reason, and you're listening to The Flatus Show with Kenty.
And Jose.
In the words which fall accidentally on a particular subject from an uninstructed sailor, I recognize the general and systematic idea upon which a great people direct all their concerns. The idea of perfection, of a continuous and endless bettering of social conditions. This idea is presented unceasingly in all its aspects.
Our original purpose in visiting America was to study its prisons. And here, as everywhere, the American spirit of perfectibility pervaded everything. Tocqueville, do you remember our first sight of the great prison of Sing Sing? We were traveling up the Hudson River on a warm May morning.
The first warm May morning. It had been quite cold up to then.
And an American chatted to us. eager, as always, to explain his country to the strangers from France.
And here's another thing you'll want to know. And now you make a note of this, too.
Yes, sir.
If you're aiming to spend a little time with us, this may be useful to you. We think a man can do anything. Anyone told you that before?
Not in so many words, but we have noticed a great flexibility.
Well, that's what we believe. We believe a man can do anything. We believe if something needs to be done, then someone can do it. We believe that people can do what they want to. If they want something, they can get it. That's what we believe, and that's the way we act. If we think anything needs to be changed, and gentlemen, I mean anything, from the face of the planet itself to the most complicated of human institutions, if we think it ought to be changed, and we know it can be changed, and we know that we can change it, and we go right ahead and do it. Now, you remember that.
We have noticed change and alteration on all sides.
Good. And there's evidence coming into sight right around that bend.
Where do you mean?
That great stone building there is a machine for changing human nature. It's the new penitentiary of Sing Sing.
But that is our destination. That is what we've come to your country to study.
Fine, gentlemen. You will find here that we don't give up even the most hardened criminal as hopeless. If man is capable of improvement, he will be improved in America.
In America, there is not only belief in progress, but there are innumerable societies to promote progress.
Oh, Beaumont, those societies. Americans of all ages, all conditions, and all dispositions constantly form associations of a thousand kinds, religious, moral, serious, futile, general or restricted, enormous or diminutive. The Americans make associations to give entertainments, to found seminaries, to build inns, to construct churches, to diffuse books, to send missionaries to the Antipodes. In this manner, they found hospitals, prisons, and schools. If it is proposed to inculcate some truth or to foster some feeling by the encouragement of a great example, they form a society. Wherever at the head of some new undertaking you see the government in France, or a man of rank in England, in the United States, you will be sure to find an association.
The American Tract Society.
The American Peace Society.
The American Home Missionary Society.
The General Union for Promoting the Christian Observance of the Sabbath.
The American Association for Redeeming Females Who Have Deviated from the Paths of Virtue.
That is to say, societies are formed to resist evils that are exclusively of a moral nature. There is no end which the human will despairs of attaining through the combined power of individuals united into a society. Consider, for example, the societies for the abolition of slavery, and the fiery words of William Lloyd Garrison, who on January the 1st, 1831, 4 months before we landed in America, published the first issue of The Liberator and proclaimed the war cry of the abolitionists.
I determined, by every hazard, to lift up the standard of emancipation in the eyes of the nation, assenting to the self-evident truth maintained in the American Declaration of Independence, that all men are created equal and endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, among which are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. I shall strenuously contend for the immediate enfranchisement of our slave population. In Park Street Church on the 4th of July, 1829, in an address on slavery, I unreflectingly assented to the popular but pernicious doctrine of gradual abolition. I seize this opportunity to make a full and unequivocal recantation, and thus publicly to ask pardon of my God, of my country, and of my brethren, the poor slaves, for having uttered a sentiment so full of timidity, injustice, and absurdity. I am aware that many may object to the severity of my language, but is there not cause for severity? I will be as harsh as truth and as uncompromising as justice. On this subject, I do not wish to think or speak or write with moderation. No! No! Tell a man whose house is on fire to give a moderate alarm. Tell him to moderately rescue his wife from the hands of the ravager. Tell the mother to gradually extricate her babe from the fire into which it has fallen. But urge me not to use moderation in a cause like the present. I am in earnest. I will not equivocate. I will not excuse. I will not retreat a single inch. And I will be heard!
Here is the intensity, the fury, the fanaticism of the man who burns to bring progress, who burns to free the 2 million Negro slaves. But all this zeal was met with counter-zeal. In the southern states, it became a crime for Negroes to read, and southern judges were severe in judgment. In Norfolk, Virginia, for example.
Of all the Negro race, there cannot be found another so large a body as the millions of slaves in the United States, at once so intelligent, so inclined to the gospel, and so blessed by the elevating influence of civilization and Christianity. But many now living will remember how and when and why the anti-slavery fury began, and by what means its manifestations were made public. Our mails were clogged with abolition pamphlets and inflammatory documents to be distributed among our southern Negroes to induce them to cut our throats. These, however, were not the only means resorted to by the northern fanatics to stir up insubordination among our slaves. They scattered far and near pocket handkerchiefs and other similar articles with frightful engravings and printed over with anti-slavery nonsense, with the view to work upon the feelings of ignorance of our Negroes, who otherwise would have remained comfortable and happy. The prisoner is therefore sentenced to 1 month in jail for the crime of teaching a Negro child to read.
But the abolitionists are not the only ones who are zealous in their wish for progress. As soon as several of the inhabitants of the United States have taken up an opinion or a feeling which they wish to promote in the world, they look out for mutual assistance. And as soon as they have found one another out, they combine. From that moment, they are no longer isolated men, but a power seen from afar, whose actions serve for an example, and whose language is listened to.
I was feeling done in, couldn't win. I'd only ever kissed before. I thought there's no use getting into heavy petting. It only leads to trouble and seat wetting. Now all I want to know is how to go. I've tasted blood and I want more. I'll put up no resistance. I want to stay the distance. I've got an itch to scratch. I need assistance. Touch a touch a touch a touch me. I wanna be dirty. Thrill me, chill me, fulfill me. Creature of the night. Then if anything grows while you pose, I'll oil you up and rub you down. And that's just one small fraction of the main attraction. You need a friendly hand. I need action. Touch a touch a touch a touch me. I wanna be dirty. Thrill me, chill me, fulfill me. Creature of the night. Touch a touch a touch a touch me. I wanna be dirty. Thrill me, chill me, fulfill me. Creature of the night. Touch a touch a touch a touch me. I want to be dirty. Thrill me, chill me, fulfill me. Creature of the night. Creature of the night. Creature of the night. Creature of the night.
That is a song, as the people themselves say, composed, selected, arranged, and adapted to the cause of total abstinence.
Do you remember, Tocqueville, that man we met in Albany on the 4th of July? The one who wanted us to join the Coldwater Army?
Gentlemen, I happen to have here a few little pamphlets which I should be pleased if you'd carry back with you for the interest and edification of the French people. I've inscribed them all on the title page, E.C. Delavan's Respects. And I hope you'll forgive the liberty.
Oh, yeah, delighted. Let me see. Second annual report of the New York Temperance Society.
Founded by myself in company with Dr. Liflet Nutt.
Most interesting, evidently. What is a temperance society?
Has to do with the evils of strong drink. I crusade against it.
Oh, of course. We agree with you. Moderation in all things.
Temperance, sir, does not mean moderation. As far as strong drink is concerned, temperance means abstinence. Let me draw your attention to some of those fine colored plates. Section of the liver of a drunkard who died miserably some little while since in Poughkeepsie.
Oh.
Interior of the stomach of a drunkard who perished in agony near Syracuse.
Ah.
Series of cross sections of the spleen.
Thank you. We have seen sufficient.
Well, they're fine pictures. I'm working now on something which I'll take the liberty of transmitting to you gentlemen, seeing that you're from France. It's to be entitled Temperance in Wine Countries. And I'm sure you'll agree that your unhappy nation certainly qualifies in that category.
Certainly, sir. The wines of France are the pride and delight of the civilized world.
Not in this quarter, they're not. The cases I've collected, you'd be surprised. If the New York Temperance Society has its way, and sooner or later it will have its way, any kind of alcohol will be totally prohibited in this state and anywhere else we can prohibit it.
But is not this an intrusion on the rights of the individual? If you do not like alcohol, well and good. But are all men to be forced to your mold? On what grounds do you propose these extraordinary things?
On the grounds of morality. You gentlemen are strangers to America. You're from Europe. You're not acquainted with morality. You are not aware of the moral force and power of aroused public opinion as it's found and cultivated in this free land of ours.
Are there a great many reformers in America who seek to influence others to their views on moral grounds?
A very great many. Some of them, of course, are nothing more than infernal busybodies. There's a gang out to try and prevent Americans from indulging in their inalienable right to chew tobacco.
Oh.
That kind of thing is just nosy Parkerism. Far removed from the wholehearted public decency of a movement such as our own. I'll leave all these pamphlets with you. Shall you be staying in town some days? Shall you be here over the 4th?
That is our expectation.
I trust the elevated tone of the proceedings will not be marred by strong drink and debauchery. However, we shall hope for the best and expect the worst.
I'll walk alone. Because to tell you the truth, I'll be lonely. I don't mind being lonely when my heart tells me you are lonely too. I'll walk alone. They'll ask me why, and I'll tell them I'd rather. There are dreams I must gather, dreams we fashioned the night you held me tight. I'll always be near you wherever you are, each night in every prayer. If you call, I'll hear you no matter how far. Just close your eyes and I'll be there. Please walk alone and send your love and your kisses to guide me till your walking beside me.
The first time I heard in the United States that 100,000 men had bound themselves publicly to abstain from spirituous liquors, it appeared to me more like a joke than a serious engagement. And I did not at once perceive why these temperate citizens could not content themselves with drinking water by their own firesides. I at last understood that these 100,000 Americans, alarmed by the progress of drunkenness around them, had made up their minds to be patrons of temperance. They acted in just the same way as a man of high rank who should dress very plainly in order to inspire the humbler orders with a contempt of luxury. It is probable that if these 100,000 men had lived in France, each of them would individually, by himself, have memorialized the government to keep an eye on the saloons and public houses.
And they were certainly effective. By 1835, there were 1,200,000 members of the American Temperance Society. There were 8,000 local affiliates and organizations in every state but one.
It is a universal American idea that the promotion of public progress is the proper concern of the private citizen. And this idea can be found clearly and explicitly stated in the American press.
I see no reason why the wildest dreams of the fanatical believer in human progress and perfectibility may not ultimately be realized. And each child so trained as to shun every vice, aspire to every virtue, attain the highest practicable skill in art and efficiency in industry, loving and pursuing honest, untasked labor for the health, vigor, and peace of mind thence resulting, as well as for its more palpable rewards, and joyfully recognizing in universal good the only assurance of individual good.
Aristocratic nations are naturally too liable to narrow the scope of human perfectibility. Democratic nations to expand it beyond reason. Democratic nations care but little for what has been, but they are haunted by visions of what will be. In this direction, their unbounded imagination grows and dilates beyond all measure. Nothing deters the American in his undertakings. Nothing discourages his efforts. He has a fund of energy in his soul to improve man and society. This same daring enterprise has given birth to American industry, whose marvels astonish me. Those canals, those railroads which penetrate the continent, the businesses which enrich the commerce of all nations, the fertile fields, the magnificent cities and smiling villages, everywhere wealth and plenty. To democratic ages belong unquestionably the ideas of progress and of the indefinite perfectibility of the human race.
Call me at 206-984-3617 and let me know what you're thinking. Are you tired of being alone? Not anymore. You can be Kenty's internet boyfriend. Just send Kenty an email or a voicemail declaring such, and a picture, and Kenty will proudly display his bevy of boyfriends in a special photo album. Now you can tell people you have a boyfriend. An internet boyfriend! There is no obligation to have sex with Kenty, go on dates, remember birthdays or anniversaries. It's that easy. B. Kenty's internet boyfriend today. And now, girls can join as well. Void where prohibited by law. Only on The Flatus Show.
Just what love will do. Love may live a day or all life.
Though the temperance banner floating free o'er a gallant band, hark the temperance legion shouting victory through the land. On to the battle on, strike the fell monster down. Fight, 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 day and night, gaze the tyrant alcohol. Fight, 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 day and night, gaze the tyrant alcohol.
Apollo's Song by Thomas Lodge. My Daphne's hair is twisted gold, bright stars apiece her eyes do hold. My Daphne's brow enthrones the graces, my Daphne's beauty stains all faces. On Daphne's cheek grow rose and cherry, on Daphne's lip a sweeter berry. Daphne's snowy hand but touched does melt, and then no heavenlier warmth is felt. My Daphne's voice tunes all the spheres. My Daphne's music charms all ears. Fond am I thus to sing her praise. These glories now are turned to bays. You've been listening to The Flatus Show. You can reach me at flatusshow@gmail.com or come by and visit my website at theflatusshow.com. Thank you for listening.
Cast the nets, play your wild duets like Hammond.